Good morning, Mr. Anderson and Mr. Hironaka. My understanding, Mr. Anderson, you reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. Is that correct? And Mr. Hironaka, you'll be getting a warning light 5 minutes with 5 minutes to go in your argument as well. Okay, please proceed then. Thank you, counsel.
Good morning. James Anderson for the state. Yeah. It's the state's position that the ICA erred grievously in reversing the convictions as to CW2, complaint witness number two, on account of Dr. Lee's testimony. Dr. Lee testified as to the threats that were made to the complaining witness. They entailed, "I wouldn't be going home if I didn't do what I was told," said he would shoot me and would be lucky to go home today because most girls don't go home. The complaining witness testified to only one of those: "Shut up or I'm going to shoot you." Now, I have 2 points to make on this. The first one is, I utilize your case of State v. Machado to show, authored by Justice Acoba, to show that it was erroneous. In that case, a police officer that it was harmless beyond reasonable doubt. In that case, a police officer testified to a recount of a domestic violence victim's, what the defendant did to her, and threatened to kill her. The complainant testified similarly, except she admitted the fact that he was going to kill me. He threatened to kill me. Now, this court held that the officer's testimony as to what the complaining witness said was far too lengthy to constitute an excited utterance, and said it was improper. But nonetheless, given the fact that the complaining witness testimony alone substantiated all the elements of the charged offenses, and the 911 tape also corroborated the killing aspect of the terroristic threatening, that it was harmless beyond reasonable doubt. Such is the case here. This lady was, there are two sex one charges. She testified uncontradicted, because the defendant didn't testify at all, uncontradicted that he penetrated her on four occasions. There are two sex three charges. He touched her breast and then put his mouth on her breast. And finally, the kidnapping, you know, with the intent to commit bodily injury, sexual offenses, or threaten. So all of those are substantiated beyond a reasonable doubt. And then, of course, we have the DNA evidence of the blood in the defendant's car, as well as her blood on his shorts. And finally, I have to say that the doctor's testimony was not as talismanic as the ICA believed, because the jury receives an instruction that it need not accept the expert's testimony, and that it is to give whatever weight it will toward that testimony. And finally, my second point, you can't ignore the evidence as to complaining victim witness number one, which was also uncontradicted, which also had DNA evidence. And because the standard is the entirety of the case, you have to look at the evidence adduced on the record, the entirety of the case. So both of these cases, both of these individuals testified beyond a reasonable doubt that they were assaulted.
But isn't the jury instructed they're supposed to consider the evidence in the two cases separately?
They surely are, sir.
And what is that? How does that principle apply in our review? Can we indeed consider what evidence regarding complaining witness one in determining the sufficiency, or I'm sorry, the strength of the evidence?
Absolutely.
For
as to determining whether it's harmless beyond reasonable doubt, the standard is you look at to the entirety of the case, not just complaining witness number two. But that's sufficient for me, actually, although I prefer you would look at both victims in this case.
Mr. Anderson, yeah. Before the ICA, the state argued that Dr. Lee's testimony was actually admissible as a statement for medical purposes or diagnosis.
I did.
And then on a but before this court, you have now conceded that the ICA was correct in ruling that was not admissible under the hearsay exception.
Yes, my argument was primarily based upon the trial court's position that, yeah, you know, these statements could go to treatment and counseling and such, but it has to be the doctor that says that. You know, it can't be the court saying that out of the hearing of the jury. It has to be the
Is the jury not entitled to draw reasonable inferences based on its own review of the evidence?
Of course.
And what is the standard upon which we would review the admissibility of the evidence under the hearsay exception?
Right or wrong.
Thank you.
But I have nothing further to ask for other questions.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Mr. Hironaka.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, Associate Justices. The inadmissible testimony regarding the alleged threats made by John were the most harmful and damaging evidence that was admitted against John in this case. And there's a few reasons for that. The first and foremost is that John's defense as to the second complainant was consent. So, you know, if the threats that came in, and again, as conceded by Mr. Anderson, the majority of them only came in through the doctor, completely negates that consent. So,
why do you present evidence of consent if the defendant didn't testify?
Well, consent can be expressed or implied. I mean, I think the instruction in the law is clear on that. And the instruction was given by the court to the jury. So I know it.
You went into the money that was found on him and her and all that, but how do you explain away the blood?
Well, the blood, okay, the physical evidence in this case, there was testimony by Dr. Lee that the complainant had basically that day started her menstrual period. So it's, I know that's not consistent with her story, but, you know, in a way that where the blood was located is also, it was also inconsistent with her story because there was blood found in the back seat of John's car, as well as other areas of the front seat where, you know, she was talking about just bleeding onto the middle console. So I don't agree with the state's contention that the physical evidence is I think they said it was objectively conclusive, that it was a non-consensual encounter. That's not true. So there are alternative explanations for the blood, and that was also pointed out during trial to the jury.
The complaining witness testified that the defendant forced her head down near the console, and so the blood that was recovered was from the cup holder and the console. Correct?
There were two cup holders in the back seat where there was blood recovered, as well as the middle console, as well as, I believe, a cup holder in the front seat as well.
So wouldn't the recovery of the blood, the places the blood was recovered from, be consistent with her testimony?
Only as to the middle console and, I guess, potentially the front cup holder, but as to the back cup holders, certainly nothing she testified to would be provide an explanation for why the blood went.
The back cup holders contain her blood too.
They were both, two of them.
And the lab technician testified to that.
That's correct. Yes, that was Kathy Mansour.
Reviewing the admissibility of the evidence in the first instance under the right-wrong standard, why would his testimony as to the threats not have been reasonable, admissible under the statements for medical purposes and diagnosis?
Well, I agree with the ICA's finding that basically there was a lack of foundation for that. So
Didn't the doctor testify that the Sex Abuse Treatment Center provide services for people that presents themselves as victims of sexual assault? And did he not testify that the SAT provides many services, including counseling?
He mentioned one time in the when he was being qualified by the deputy prosecuting attorney that the SATC does provide counseling among other services. And then it was not mentioned any further. It wasn't fleshed out. And so when the questions came up about the threats, basically it wasn't like that. You know, I mean, the second part of the
Didn't she testify twice that before he asked her that she was scared?
She testified that, well, I'm sorry, I think what I meant was.
And that's why she didn't say anything to the defendant?
She testified as to that. That was what she actually testified after the doctor, but she did
No, she testified twice before he asked her that she was scared, did she not?
I'm sorry, I'm not sure. She did testify that she was scared during the encounter. But the doctor, the foundation is lacking is he didn't say why it's reasonably pertinent to medical diagnosis or treatment. So that's where, you know.
Isn't that the jury's province?
Well, I think it would be, but they need to be given the ability to find that it's reasonably pertinent to medical diagnosis or treatment. And they weren't done that. You know, if he had said, look, I typically have to examine people to diagnose things like post-traumatic stress disorder or other psychological or emotional trauma, then I could, then maybe they could try the foundation and show that it might be admissible under that. I will also note that, and I wasn't sure if we were going to get into the admissibility of the threats at all, you know, if the proper foundation was laid, but the history and the intent behind 803b4, I think, and this hasn't really been developed yet, I think, in Hawaii, but it's sort of, I don't want to say flies in the face, but that exception was carved out because I think a layperson can say, I have a broken arm, this is how I got it, and they have an interest in being honest about that to a doctor. A layperson can maybe say, I feel like I'm having some, you know, emotional or psychological issues, but the exception wasn't, it's a little bit more difficult. I mean, it's not as easy, I think, for a layperson to say, I have PTSD, and I think this is why. I think it's because he threatened me, or he said these things. And I'll also point out that even if a person thought that they were having emotional or psychological problems, that could result from the physical nature of the event itself. But what we have here is we have threats that came in under this very narrow exception, and that I don't think the exception should be broadened to the point of allowing things like threats, or certainly not ID. The example actually from the commentary is very good when it talks about somebody saying they were in an automobile accident but not being able to say, and being able to say I got hit by a car but not being able to say the car ran a red light, that I would further argue that person could not say claim the identity of that person or say that person was drinking a beer as well or something like that. The exception is very narrowly limited to I would argue physical injuries and how they came about.
But in this case, we're talking about the sex abuse treatment center, which also has to think of the psychological or injuries from an alleged sex abuse, correct?
That is true. The doctor did also, though, when he was talking about what he was, the things that he was looking for, he used as an example, I take an incident history that includes a historical examination, and he used the example of somebody coming in and saying, I have a sore throat. And then the doctor would ask, okay, how long have you had it? Do you have a cough? Do you have a fever? Have you been hanging around anybody else who is sick? So he's, from the get-go and throughout his testimony, other than the threats, he's talking about physical manifestations. He's talking about things that he can look for, identify, and that's corroborated by the fact that during his physical examination, he said, I had to remove her clothes to check for marks. I took pictures if there was anything noticeable, and I checked for bruises, scratches, bite marks, tenderness. He goes on for approximately 20 pages talking about the physical things that he's looking for and does not mention at all. There's no testimony as to whether or not he's doing any of this to assess any psychological or emotional injuries of the complainant.
Well, the exception is based on the fact that you would consider hearsay statements with respect to treatment trustworthy because people are less likely to feign what the symptoms if they're going to a doctor for treatment.
Exactly.
So in this particular case, it's not pretty obvious that the purpose of it was to conduct a physical examination in order to verify that there was, in fact, sexual assault. She wasn't attending that. She didn't go to see this doctor for treatment.
Well, she, part of that is correct, but I guess she, I'll concede that part of the purpose was also for treatment. I mean, it was to perform this physical examination and determine if there was, but on its face, I agree that there's no, there was nothing that she, I guess, immediately needed to be
I just want to get this straight, because at trial, the defense's position was it's not treatment. Now you're saying it is treatment?
Oh, no, no, no. I'm saying that it, I mean, I'm sorry, are we talking about the threats?
Yes.
Or her entire examination?
The reason why the hearsay statements made by the complaining witness were not admissible in evidence as the ICA rule.
Oh, that's correct, right. Not for treatment. I thought we were talking about the whole exam. I would concede that the physical part of the exam could potentially be for treatment, but not the...
Was there any evidence as to whether or not this complaining witness saw anyone else at the sex abuse treatment center?
I don't believe so. There was a crisis worker that testified, but I think they just recovered the results of the examination from Dr. Lee.
And Dr. Lee did testify that the SAT provides many services, from counseling to forensic examination to education, correct?
Correct. But there was no, I guess, again, there wasn't that follow-up testimony to link up that foundation. And as you pointed out, she didn't see anybody else other than Dr. Lee.
But could not the jury have inferred that, in, given the circumstances, that the overall purpose of this examination included evaluation for treatment, that based on those kinds of threats or reporting of those kinds of threats could reasonably indicate a need for psychological treatment?
I think a jury could infer that, but again, the jury wasn't provided with any testimony or any basis to conclude what that treatment would consist of, or for what conditions, or for what psychological or emotional conditions, and that they cannot infer. And so that's why it needed to be, that foundation needed to be laid through Dr. Lee at a minimum, and it was not.
Even if this testimony came in, would it be harmless in the sense that in order to prove strong compulsion, all the state needed to prove was that there was physical force use or threats?
That's correct. But
and there's ample evidence in the record, is there not, of a great deal of force?
I'm gonna say no, and this is the reason why. Might seem sort of counterintuitive, but there was a lot of testimony as to beatings that John inflicted. This is what the complainant testified to, which were not corroborated by her physical injuries. The other thing is, when she was describing the sexual assault itself, it wasn't, I guess, sort of your classic, hold down using physical force in that nature. She was very clear that he, to her to get on top of him, that I know it's at his direction, but that's not, I don't think, within the definition of physical force. So that's why the threats become even more harmful in this case.
Hadn't he beaten her already on the highway? It wasn't her testimony that he had beaten her on the way over already, and that at some point she determined that she was not going to endure beatings anymore, but was rather going to comply with his demands?
And she tied that up by saying, she did say it's because I didn't want to get beat anymore, I didn't want to get hurt anymore, I don't know if she said she wanted to get it over with, but it might be splitting hairs to say that she's complying because she's afraid and because she's been threatened, or she's complying because of the prior beatings that she got. But whether that falls under the quote-unquote definition of physical force is at least arguable. I don't think it's a black and white issue where we can say, okay, we have overwhelming evidence of physical force, and so the threats were rendered harmless.
Well, she testified she was punched, and he pulled her hair.
Previously.
And, well, that was part of the interaction, right? And the doctor corroborated it by saying he saw abrasions and bruises and scratches and lumps. And you had the testimony of Ogawa, who said she came running towards him saying she was raped, and She was bloody and frantic. And so you have Ogawa's testimony. You have the lab technician at least corroborating where that her blood was in the car and on her jeans, and at least linking up some of her testimony with the location of the blood. So, and then of course the lab technician verifying that that was her blood. So doesn't that constitute overwhelming evidence?
It doesn't for these reasons. Ogawa's testimony comes from the second complaint. Her credibility is the central issue in this case. And if she, if they had a consensual encounter, you know, because we know on its face that she voluntarily got into John's car, they went for a ride. At some point during this ride up the pulley is where, you know, allegedly his demeanor changed and he became violent. And then when they got to Mama Willie, you know, and then some beatings occurred in the car, according to the complainant. Then when they got to Mama Willie Elementary School, at that point, I know we're past what she's saying, the threats and the beatings occurred, but the jury is free to disregard those things, to say, hey, they had a consensual sexual encounter, and at some point they got into a, because this was John's position, even though he didn't testify, was that at some point they got into an argument about something else. That's why she went running out to the street. That's why she flagged down Mr. Ogawa. All the information that he has comes from the second complaint. It doesn't come from anything that he ended up going, driving over there and observing, you know, John by the car. I mean, there is overwhelming evidence of identity in this case, but there is not overwhelming evidence of sexual assault.
Well, identity wasn't even an issue because the defendant, in effect, admitted he had relations with the complaining witness.
Right. There's no doubt, and that I think that was Judge Alm's rationale. I mean, not to bring up another point that's not before us, but that was his rationale for not severing the cases, was to say, hey, look, this goes to motives goes to identity. So, you know, it's still on the state to prove those things. So I would submit that we do have overwhelming evidence of identity, but we don't have overwhelming evidence that...
Well, against all this evidence, you just have these two statements, well, three statements.
Correct.
One that she did repeat in her testimony that the doctor... She said she was the defendant threatened to shoot her,
friendship,
or kill her. And then the other two statements, she'd be lucky to go home, and most girls don't go home. Could you infer from the fact that the defendant supposedly told her that there was another girl, and she had tried to get away, and he had broken her arm or something, or that if she did what he told her to do, then she'd be safe. Could you infer from that testimony that pretty much overlapped what the doctor said in terms of the two statements you said, or two threats you said was not set out in the complaining witness's testimony?
No, because again, that comes from the second. I mean, she's the only one who said, you know, that John made that statement. And I think this maybe goes to Mr. Anderson's argument that the court has to consider the evidence involving the first complainant as well. And I wholeheartedly disagree with that. I mean, that flies in the face of everything that we know about criminal law. That'd be the same as arguing to the jury, well, he did it the first time, he must have done it.
Yeah, what I just recited to you, though, is what? Pertain only to the complaining witness number two. Yeah. Complaining witness number one. What he related to complaining witness number two was what he did to complaining witness number one. But we're not talking about the evidence submitted with respect to complaining witness number one.
Right, and that's why, again, I think I will concede that there's overwhelming evidence of identity in this case, but that's all. It's not... A jury, it would be improper for a jury to take that statement to say, well, she knows about the first incident, so he must be guilty in the second incident. That's where I think it's related. So it's It's splitting hairs, and I know it's difficult to argue that before a jury, but it would, that the these two cases being tried together, evidence like that is only admitted for the purposes of establishing identity.
I guess what I'm saying is you're weighing these two statements about threats as against all this other evidence about physical force.
And
all you need for kidnapping and the sexual assault offenses is physical force.
Only physical force would be sufficient, that's correct. But our position is that there wasn't overwhelming evidence beyond a reasonable doubt that those offenses were satisfied by physical force. Physical force alone, I guess. There's still, again, there's inconsistent scientific evidence as to what the complainant was saying. Her blood had no business being in the back seat of John's car. So that alone, attacks her credibility and calls into question what she's saying about what happened. So if there's, and the state's case did rely, if we rely only on the testimony of the second complainant without these threats, there wouldn't have been enough evidence. Her lack of credibility and the lack of physical evidence matching up with what she's saying occurred wouldn't have been enough. So that's why the threats became so harmful. And the threats do go to both strong compulsion as well as the kidnapping statute and completely negates his defense of implied consent. So that is why, if the standard that we're looking at is that there is any is there any possibility, reasonable possibility, that the error might have contributed to his convictions? Certainly. Because the jury might very well have rejected that, physical force was the basis for these convictions, and used the threats that were relayed through somebody who's qualified as an expert witness. So that's why it's so harmful in this case.
If that completes your argument, Mr. Hironaka, we appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Anderson, any rebuttal?
Yeah. I just have one point that I'd like to make with your permission. When you asked me, Your Honor, whether the instruction to the jury that they consider the charges against each person with respect to each victim separately, that goes to whether the conviction aspect. But in determining harmless error, you look at the entirety of the case. And that's it. That's all I have.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Anderson. Thank you, Mr. Hironaka. The court will take this matter under advisement.